This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. It's 11:26. Under construction is a sign you'll see on Atlanta Road all summer long. It's also the marker you could affix to any teenager's head. Powerful new technologies are enabling brain researchers, healthcare professionals, and educators to investigate the connections among brain function, development, and behavior in adolescence. One of the interesting threads emerging from this research is the power of music as a therapeutic and pedagogical tool. To look into the teenage brain, we march in where others fear to tread with two colleagues from the Westminster Schools in Atlanta, neuroscientist Dr. Anna Moore and WABE contributor and music faculty member Dr. Scott Stewart. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Morning, Lois.
Happy to be here.
Great to have you here. Anna, good to have you back, too. We're getting new information about the teenage brain and its development during adolescence. So what are we learning?
Well, not all that long ago, it was assumed that brain development was very rich, fertile ground throughout early childhood. We knew that infant and toddler brains were busy growing and changing. The implication of that way of thought was then that the teenage brain wasn't really doing much.
Some parents might agree with that.
That's right. Maybe being inundated by hormones, but otherwise not much. We now know that those were big misconceptions about the teenage brain. There is rich potential in an adolescent brain. In fact, preteen and earliest teen years, the brain is undergoing neurogenesis, meaning new cells are being made during this time. On top of that, the brain then begins to work in an astonishing way to build fibers connecting all of these cells. And the cells that don't have strong connections built up with other cells, these cells actually will die off. So the teen brain is undergoing radical transformation.
Molting, if you will.
Yes.
Is this the neuroscience version of use it or lose it?
Very much so. These are skills that if you have when you're an adolescent and you want to continue into your adult life and think of playing a musical instrument, performing some kind of athletic endeavor, being in debate, being in construction, whatever it might be, you should hone these in your teen years because much like a garden, the brain is pruning or sloughing off some of its circuits while at the same time adding new connections to these skills that you are practicing. And so all of this neurogenesis, this transformation, and I usually think of this as like remodeling my house. It happens during adolescence and it causes other people to shrink in horror when they just hear that word, teenager. But what I find as a teacher really exhilarating and at times a little exasperating about this age group is that the teen brain remains highly receptive to training. Through what happens in classrooms and out of the classwork we are inspiring our students to do, we can change the way that the brain cells actually connect and communicate in the brains of our students.
Exactly. We used to think the brain you're born with is essentially the brain you die with. But we know now the teen brain is highly plastic, meaning these cells have the ability to rearrange. They can change how they communicate and with which cells they communicate. So in a very unique way, teen brains can create connections and patterns of activation among cells. And as a high school teacher, for me, this is especially important because it means I need to expose my students to new ways of thinking, exploring, and trying things on to really leverage this time of neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
And it ends up that when we're born, we have so many more neurons than we're ever going to use. And so we go through childhood and absorb all of this sensory information like sponges through this a period maybe up to age 10 or 11, and then we have this pre-puberty exuberance period, and you know this kid. This is the kid that cannot stop asking questions. They're just loading up on information, and then puberty hits. There's a fabulous neuroscientist named Jill Bolte Taylor, and she has her own little exuberant description of what happens during the puberty period.
And with puberty comes several major shifts. One of the first ones is we're going to go through a major physical growth spurt, right? And when we go through a major physical growth spurt, our entire body changes, right? And it changes, and it's not as agile. So our amygdala are on a little bit of alert, a little bit of alert. It's very interesting, but it's a little bit of alert. What's going on? What's going on? And then on top of that, then we're going to have our hormonal systems are going to start flowing through our body. And with that are going to come all kinds of mood swings and all kinds of interesting behaviors. And then on top of that, there's going to be what we call a pruning back of 50% of the synaptic connections inside of our brain. We literally lose half our minds. We literally lose half our minds. How does that feel? Unfamiliar. I used to know all this stuff. It isn't there anymore. I used to be interested in these things. That doesn't do that. I used to look like something, and I used to want to hang out with them, and now I'm hanging out with this. And then on top of it, oh my gosh, unfamiliar. We're going to grow testosterone receptors on our amygdala. And when that comes, aggression, I feel a little aggressive. There are biological reasons for the teenage years. There's biology underlying everything you're feeling, everything you're thinking, and everything you are experiencing.
In case you feel like you've just had your morning espresso, that was Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor, neuroscientist.
On helium, I
she think. Is fantastic. Check out some of her TED Talks on the internet. She's really wonderful and has a great grasp for the adolescent brain. I love that last line. There is a biological explanation for everything that happens during puberty. The last portion of the brain that kind of comes online, as it were, is the prefrontal cortex. That's the area right behind your forehead. And this is where we have planning and impulse control and the consequential behavior and appropriate behavior being processed. This becomes increasingly connected, although not completely connected, through the mid-20s.
So all those guys in Animal House had a biological
there was a reason.
Well, this is all very exciting news, although there are some downsides, I would think, to the plasticity in teenage brains. And Jill kind of hinted at that with her, oh my God, where's this? I used to know this.
Exactly right. She did. The liability or the flip side to all of this plasticity and brain change is the teen brain is more vulnerable to things like addiction, emotional challenges. One example would be when given a drug, a teen brain, unlike an adult brain, can actually build more receptors or entry portals for that drug to enter a brain cell. Mm. Since the prefrontal cortex is not fully online in a teen, we often find adolescents who will engage in a reckless behavior, and later a parent or someone will say, why did you do that? And they'll respond with, I don't know. And the thing is, they don't necessarily know. That limbic system, it got excited to do something, to seek pleasure or a reward, and the frontal lobe was not yet fully connected to let that brain pause to think through the ramifications. All of that being said, we cannot lose sight of the positive news here. The teen brain is remarkably ready to receive new information and to learn.
You're listening to City Lights on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's NPR station. I'm Lois Reitzes, and we're investigating music in the teenage brain with Drs. Anna Moore and Scott Stewart. Back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Whole Foods Market, now offering Atlanta Fresh 100% grass-fed milk from non-GMO verified Georgia cows. Atlanta Fresh Milk, now available at Whole Foods Market.
So given what we've learned about the developing teen brain in just the last few minutes, how do we connect this to music and education?
Well, music has been a part of American education first since the singing schools back in 1717, and it wasn't really a fancy reason to include music in the schools. It was so people could sing better in church, and eventually it helped with literacy. When it was formally introduced about 100 years later in the 1830s into public education, supporters for music in the schools have justified it on its own terms as an aesthetic and artistic education, as well as helping to develop good moral character.
But in light of all we've recently heard, are we finally receiving validation from the scientific community for what musicians have known or claimed for years?
Yeah, I think we are. We're now seeing many emerging studies, including a recent exciting one from Northwestern University, that suggests that music study may enhance skills in non-musical areas that are critical for academic and later life success. Researcher Nina Kraus from the Northwestern Auditory Neuroscience Laboratory tracked students from Chicago area high schools from their freshman year through their senior year, with about half of the students enrolled in band classes and half in ROTC, and those classes emphasized physical fitness. So the brain function mapping from the start of the study and then 3 years later showed that the music group showed more rapid maturation in response to sound and heightened sensitivity to sound details. And so the researchers are suggesting that music training may hone brain development and improve hearing, listening, and language skills.
Well, what we do during our lives and how we engage with sound has a profound effect on our nervous system. And we know that our nervous system is an adaptive sensory system and that it changes throughout our lives based on the experiences that we have. And so if you spend your time learning to play a musical instrument, it can have a profound effect on how your nervous system works. And so I'm not talking about the transient effects of music on your mood, for example. I'm talking about the long-lasting, fundamental effects that musical experience has on nervous system development. And it's something that happens throughout our lives. And importantly, it impacts very basic communication skills.
That's Dr. Nina Kraus from Northwestern University discussing some of her work examining the benefits of music on the brain.
This is fascinating. And it seems both healthcare and education are looking to music as a tool in their respective fields.
As a clinical neuropsychologist, I find myself intrigued and excited by the use of music therapies to help with things like language disorder after stroke, memory retrieval in the earliest stages of dementia, for example, movement disorders seen in Parkinson's even. I think science and medicine are pushing this domain forward. Educators are just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of thinking about music beyond just its value as an aesthetic or an elective or an add-on. In terms of application to schools, I think we're seeing an enthusiasm for the idea of folding in music education.
You mean how it applies to schools?
Exactly.
Not applying to schools.
Correct. Okay. Yes, thank you. But we haven't really scratched the surface in terms of that application.
Well, want to hear more about this. I'm with Dr. Scott Stewart and Dr. Anna Moore, learning more about music and the brain. Today's episode, Teenagers. We'll be back in a moment. This is City Lights on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Sherrian Rugs. With 85 years' experience, Sherrian Rugs has cared for heirloom oriental rugs of Atlanta families and businesses. When needed, Sherrian professional rug cleaning specialists and weavers can help preserve your rugs. More at Sherrian.com.
So in terms of brain development, why does music education resonate so strongly in school curricula? What are the implications for teaching, and how can we get more people to buy into this?
Exactly. I think more and more we see education pushing to create learning opportunities that are cross-curricular, sort of a buzzword. Words like collaborate, communicate, these have become part of the daily fabric of education and educational structure. This matches what we know about how the brain works as well. There's a remarkable synergy here. Neuroimaging has shown us that huge regions of the brain will activate when we attempt to do almost any task. So the human brain is not really a very compartmentalized structure. It's quite integrated. In education, we should take advantage of that when we teach, and we should work to nourish and enhance that integrated quality. There's actually research suggesting that use of music and the arts might foster creativity, especially when we allow students the opportunity to create and explore a little on their own as they create music. Further, I would assert we could use music to train mindfulness and attention skills in students.
How so?
I think when you consider a broad piece of music and then you invite students to listen for a specific change in pitch or a tone, changes in rhythm or tempo, for example, we begin to teach young people to parse their attention, to focus it in a more discreet way. We live in a world now that's so fast-paced and character-limited and soundbite-driven that we don't often practice that skill of attention and mindful awareness.
So this is very helpful in terms of focus, and this spills over into all areas of learning.
I would argue so.
And I think that music study in itself, and I'm speaking as a music educator here, is really important. But the research that we're getting now is that it also may be important in terms of other areas of functioning. It's not just for the can-dos, those who can sing and play. It's really something that everybody should have in their education experience. I'm certainly not comfortable asserting that being in orchestra makes you score higher on the SAT. But I'm also not comfortable with policymakers stating that music should be cut from a curriculum because it's just a fluffy add-on in favor of STEM classes.
Absolutely. Now, what we're discussing does bring to mind that study from the 90s about the Mozart effect, and it certainly made it easy to buy baby gifts. I mean, all those, you can still find them in the children's section, in the baby, newborn, you know,
that is
gifts.
True.
Mozart makes you smarter and baby
loves
Bach.
Oh, yeah, you can get little earbuds that can strap up to your tummy. the Mozart effect claimed a lot of sensational benefits of music listening without much scientific support. And it was quickly followed up by lots of products to purchase on behalf of Mozart's name. And don't forget, here in Georgia in 1998, the governor, Zell Miller, proposed that each baby born would be presented with a classical music CD so that they would be smarter
now,
when they grew up.
I don't think that was a bad idea. I applauded that.
I'm all for Mozart. This was a case, I think, of good intentions, not executed in the best way. I think it's safe to say that music participation does have benefits for the brain, but it's not quite as simple as saying listening to Mozart makes you smarter.
Of course.
On the other hand, we have this growing body of research that suggests that music education and participation in singing and playing does positively impact other abilities. And this ranges from prenatal development all the way through adult learners.
You know, really, this idea of the prenatal development piece fascinates me, too. We know that almost immediately after conception, within 20 days or so, the clump of cells that goes on to become a baby starts to beat in a rhythm. This rhythmic, unified beating is one of the first things that this group of cells does. So I think a response to rhythm seems to be a core and essential part of humanness. As a high school teacher, something I wrestle with along these lines is when I have students who want to play music while they read or do homework or study for their tests. This is a complex topic, to be sure. One truth I share with my students in these moments is that the human brain simply cannot multitask. We cannot pay attention to two things at once. So, for example, music with lyrics could pull the student off track if she's trying to read or write. The words could start to compete with one another. I encourage them instead to take a music break while they're studying. They can boost their energy, refocus, have a dance party, whatever they need, and then settle back in.
So, Anna and Scott, we're gathering research about the positive effects of music on the developing brain at a quickening pace. How can schools use this information when thinking about using music education in their planning and programming?
Well, Lois, I would first advocate for the inclusion of performing arts education on an equal footing with traditional subjects for development of aesthetics and creativity and self-expression just by themselves. Additionally, if we know how music changes the brain in ways that affect other cognitive abilities, it could have a major impact on the value that's assigned in schools. We hear lots of stories on NPR about music and other performing and visual arts being the ugly duckling in the curriculum, and this national obsession with test scores and math and science achievement. So I'm hoping this research may help us turn the corner from this pretty pervasive attitude and bring a little bit more balance into curricula.
And I think even looking beyond a high school education, for example, college education, when we look at what medical schools, law schools, the professional world is seeking, they want not just people with a high test score, for example, mm-hmm. but they're looking for people who are creative, who have empathy, who can think outside of the box. And I believe we're starting to see lines of research that indicate to us that music is an avenue for nourishing these skills, these mm-hmm. qualities.
And of course, those qualities are really hard to measure. They're the ones that are continually being cited as the most important attributes of being a good parent or a good spouse or partner or a great neighbor or a good student. But those are a little more difficult than that Saturday morning exam. It's tough to assess things like teamwork and improvisation and communication skills, self-discipline, but those are the things that are continually surfacing as the most desired personal qualities in all of these areas of life. So ultimately, music education, I think, can address emotional maturity, social skills, and other vital character qualities that can lead a child to success, however they choose to define that success.
And when you're talking about this kind of teamwork, you mentioned improvisation, communication, self-discipline, sociability. Mm-hmm. I think of an orchestra or band.
Of course.
Think of a play, a dance, anything that these students are putting on together, there are many layers of mm-hmm. meaning.
It's a little society where they have to practice being good people.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
I'm with two very good people, Dr. Scott Stewart, Dr. Anna Moore, talking about music and the brain. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment. You're listening to WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Horizon Theater's The Kink in My Hair, an international sold-out hit and TV show, an unforgettable musical journey of hope and beauty in a very special hair salon. Incredible, uncensored, uplifting. The Kink in My Hair, now at Horizon Theater. And from the law firm of Miller Bonham, whose attorneys represent clients in catastrophic injury and wrongful death matters stemming from fires, explosions, defective products, and vehicle collisions. Miller Bonham. More at MillerBonham.com.
It's 11:49. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining me here with Scott Stewart and Anna Moore. And the idea that teenagers are ruled by their raging hormones and immaturity, now that we've learned all of this from you, is that a misconception?
Well, we definitely have hormones, so we can't deny that fact. The limbic system is what we're talking about. That's that inner part of the brain that governs emotions. There are a whole bunch of different structures that are part of the limbic system, but this is the emotional center, and it supports a variety of different functions. In fact, this, Anna, is the reptilian brain, right?
It's
the
exactly
oldest
right.
part of the brain that's found in a lot of our ancestors. So we're talking about pleasure. We're talking about behavior and motivation, why we decide to do things. Also, through the amygdala and the hippocampus, we have a sense of a question that goes on all the time. Am I safe? Am I safe? Am I safe? And based on the answer to that question, whether the sensory information around us is familiar or unfamiliar, then we have physiological responses to whether you feel safe or not. Mm-hmm. Also, I find fascinating that this same general area where music emotional information is processed is mm-hmm. the same place where we code long-term memory and smell.
You know, this would help account for, or at least maybe help us better understand synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing more and more examples of musicians who say that they have little movies in their
head. They see colors
yes.
when they hear sounds.
Yes.
Yeah, really interesting pairings.
You know, famous composers, mm-hmm. Olivier Messiaen, they were synesthetes. Well, Anna, How can we assess and sum up all of this wonderful information?
I think continuing to explore use of music education in the schools, working with students, exposing them to music. I think continuing to delve into the research, looking at the benefits of music education as far as mindfulness, training for attention. I think in particular, too, with teens, an interesting place to consider the role of music is in raising awareness for emotional intelligence. I think adults need to actively teach emotional intelligence so teens can have an awareness of what's going on, but also the skills to manage those emotions, those feelings in the present and the future. I find music to be one of the most powerful disciplines for addressing emotional intelligence for many of the reasons we've said. It engages the whole brain. It does facilitate an awareness, a mindfulness. It creates space for one to deeply move into and feel emotions. So these would be avenues I think are well worth continuing to explore.
And I think one of the contentions that we'd like to make is that the music classroom, the music experience in school, provides a very safe and familiar venue for teenagers to explore their emotional intelligence, maybe more so than in traditional subject areas. We've been talking about mindfulness, this idea of observing your own brain in action, and also the idea that not only can we monitor our own thoughts, but we can change them. So we have the capability to be aware of what's happening to us inside, but also the ability to reroute some of those emotions. And that's the whole idea of emotional intelligence.
It's a concept we hear more frequently, and as applied to so many different areas, it's really been enlightening to hear you talk about this in terms of music and the teenage brain. Dr. Anna Moore is on the science faculty, and Dr. Scott Stewart is on the music faculty at the Westminster Schools in Atlanta. Thank you both so very much.
Thanks for having
us. My pleasure. Thank you.